Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or Out Across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us Stephen Peltier, and we're going to be talking about his book, Iraq and the International Oil System, Why America Went to War in the Gulf. Thank you so very much for being with us today.
Very good.
Well, now, of course, you've been reading and studying about this situation as far as oil in the Middle East for some time, haven't you?
Oh, quite a bit of time.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you sort of give us, our listeners, a little background behind your views? And then, of course, you have a fascinating history of the of this world oil industry and of the cartels and, of course, why your contention is that we really had very little choice other than to go to war in the Middle East to try to bring this under control. So, first of all, do you want to get at all into the history of the oil? Because I learned so much about how this original cartel was created and then what happened when it was broken up.
No, it's to make it as brief as possible, the cartel originally was formed by three oil companies, what today would be Exxon and British Petroleum and Shell. And the cartel was formed in the 1920s, and it very quickly moved its center of gravity to the Persian Gulf, and it did that because the oil was easy to extract from there. There was plenty of it. The people who controlled the oil at the time, that is the local rulers, could be easily swayed. And the companies put enormous amounts of money into the fields in Saudi Arabia and Iran, and as a consequence, made enormous amounts of money, but also meant that ultimately, those countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia, pretty much control the production of oil worldwide.
And, of course, the book really starts with the discussion of the Rockefeller interests and then with competition with what came to be the Royal Dutch Shell, the American Shell Company, and then Royal Dutch Shell. And then, of course, it evolves into a discussion of how this whole system then came to be controlled by an oil cartel, really of the OPEC. And, of course, the problem with that is, of course, if they run the price of oil up too high, it would have a profound impact on our own economic situation, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. That most people don't understand that the problem with oil is not to physically possess it. It's to have, as we say, the usufruct over it. It is to be able to control the production. If you can control the production of oil, that is, run up the production when the price, when there's too much oil around, when there's not enough oil around, and vice versa, you can affect the price, making it go up and down at will. And Saudi Arabia has that ability.
And it certainly does. And, of course, you, of course, point out the fact that there was a danger that Saddam Hussein would come to dominate the oil of the world. At least you feel that's one of the reasons why we had the first Gulf War?
Well, I think that the United States, as I point out in my book, failed to perceive that Iraq was going to win that war with Iran. You remember there was an 8-year war between the Iraqis and the Iranians. And the United States assumed throughout that these two countries would just go on fighting forever, that neither one had the ability to finish off the other. When unexpectedly the Iraqis imposed a decisive defeat on the Iranians, America awoke to the fact that the balance of power in the Gulf was now considerably altered, and Saddam Hussein was in a position to assert his will inside the Gulf, and the United States could not stand for that.
And so that was the real reason why the war was fought there, not why we had the initial Gulf War?
I think that there were a number of reasons why we fought the Gulf War, but I think it's safe to say that it was America's unwillingness to allow the Iraqis to not only control the production of their own oil, but to take control of OPEC, that probably is what impelled the United States to go to war.
All right, fine. And so, of course, we have this war and a humiliating defeat imposed upon Saddam Hussein. And, of course, the continued American bombing and embargoes against Iraq in the intervening years. And, of course, I have the feeling from reading your book that you were absolutely certain that we would eventually have another war with Iraq.
I do end up the book by saying that. The book was published in 2001, and before the Twin Towers attack, and it certainly has turned out that way. Yes, in the book I do predict that if we didn't go to war with Iraq, we would likely go to war with some other oil-producing state.
And, of course, so why was it? In other words, why were we going to go to war over there? Why was a war in the Middle East so important to American foreign policy?
Well, I think that you have to understand that for years, the United States has been getting more and more deeply enmeshed in the Gulf, not only with the oil of the Gulf, but you have to be aware that we sell an enormous amount of weapons to the oil sheikhs. The Saudis and the Kuwaitis buy billions and billions of dollars of weapons from us every year, and for a while they actually were supporting the arms industry here in the United States. As a consequence, you have two staple industries, the arms production industry and the oil industry, which are centered in the Gulf. And with a situation like that, the United States has to have some control over what goes on inside that area. And as I said a moment ago, it appeared for a brief time in 1988 when Iraq defeated Iran that we were going to lose control.
All right, fine. We're going to take a break. I'm going to ask if you'll just hang up. I'm going to have my producer call you right back, see if we can get a little bit of a line, okay?
Very good.
You're on a regular hardline telephone, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. If you'll just hang up, our producer will call you right back.
Right.
Okay, fine, and this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, this is the time I just want to remind you about certain of the items that we carry at Radio Liberty, which we think, we hope, of course, that you will want to get, and one of those, of course, would be the Be Alive Royal Jelly products. I've taken them myself for about 8 to 10 years. They're designed really to give you a certain amount of pep. There are other things that they probably do, but of course, the manufacturer's not allowed to mention those, but they are allowed to mention that it seems to increase energy, and the people who have used the Royal Jelly products for many years will attest to that fact. Now, the Royal Jelly is what the Queen Bee eats, and of course she lives to be about 6 years of age, whereas the average bee lives to be about 6 weeks of age. So if you'd like to try Royal Jelly products, which are available, give us a call or give them the manufacturers to call at 866-233-7500. That's 866-233-7500. The products are sold with a money-back guarantee. And then I want to mention, of course, our conference we're going to be holding at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. It's going to be on the 23rd of November. That's the weekend before Thanksgiving. And, of course, it's going to be an all-day session. It's going to start at 8:45 in the morning. Doors are going to open at 8 in the evening, and we'll be there until 6 in the evening. So it's going to start at doors will open at 8 in the morning. We will be there probably until 6 in the evening. There will be a luncheon. We need to know if you're going to be able to come, so please give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Please come, bring your friends. We're going to talk about preparation for the difficult times ahead. Well, if there's any one tape that you should hear, it's my talk on geopolitics, an untold story that is vitally important if America is to survive as a free nation. It goes into the background of the forces that have created the wars of the 20th century, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam. We go into the ideological and the spiritual battle behind the forces that have moved America from crisis to crisis and are currently undermining the very fabric of our society. That number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and the tape, Geopolitics. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of my talk on geopolitics. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this afternoon is Stephen Pelletier, and we're talking about his book, Iraq and the International Oil System, which was actually published before the attack on the World Trade Center last year. And, of course, there were a lot of interesting points in this book, a lot of things that I didn't know about the Iran-Iraqi war, and that was that Iran actually amassed about almost a million men for their final push, this great decisive battle that they were going to thrust against Iraq with the idea of overwhelming Iraq. And instead of overwhelming Iraq, why Iran was defeated, and of course, would you like to discuss that just a little bit? Because, of course, our State Department can say, well, the only reason that the Iraqis stopped them was because of the use of poison gas. So what really happened in this great final battle? Must have been, what, about 1988?
Actually, the decisive battle came in 1987.
Okay.
It was an attempt by the Iranians to capture the Iraqi city of Basra. And they did, as you said, amass an army of 1 million men. And they literally threw themselves against the Iraqi line, which was defending Basra. Remember that the Iranians pioneered the tactic of a human wave attack. They would just keep pouring men against their enemy, in this case, Iraq. The Iraqis, however, are excellent engineers, and they had doped out a quite effective strategy. They built artificial berms, and then they arranged the berms so that when the Iranians came on in a rush, they effectively poured in between the berms, had nowhere to go except to continue pell-mell deeper and deeper along the tunnel set up between the berms. And then the Iraqis had arranged the berms so that they would come out in a killing ground. Suddenly these masses of Iranians would pour out and the Iraqis were waiting for them there and they slaughtered them. So many Iranians were killed in this battle that the Iranian army literally fell apart. And the following year, they could not mount another attack, and it was in 1988 that the Iranians surrendered.
Well, now, of course, how many people died in these human wave attacks? Do we have any idea?
It's very difficult to estimate casualties. The CIA attempted to do so, but in the end, the agency had to resort to guesstimates. If you read a history of the Iran-Iraq War, you will see that most of the battles that were fought, the estimates of dead are usually 3-1 in favor of Iraq, and that is because that was the disparity between the two populations. The Iranians have 3 times more people than the Iraqis, and so the CIA just routinely said, well, it was a battle, and the Iraqis are still standing, so they didn't wipe them out, so we'll just say it was a 3-1 casualty.
But it was a horrible, horrible, bloody carnage. And, you know, here over in America, we were totally oblivious of the horror that was going on over there between these two countries. And the thing that is so disturbing, that we were financing both sides. We were actually helping both sides. And you pointed out, of course, at one point that we were giving the Iraqis the Iranian war plans, but we were also giving the Iranians some of the Iraqi war plans, weren't we?
Yeah, this all came out in the Iran-Contra affair when it was developed that the United States was giving the Iraqis satellite pictures of the Iranians emplacements along the battle line, but at the same time the United States was selling weapons to Iran, weapons which could be used to break through the Iraqi line. Of course, the Iraqis knew nothing about this. It all came out when Iran-Contra came out into the open.
And so you really, you sell weapons to both sides, you have a terrible carnage, play one adversary or potential adversary against another, and of course, as a result, why, you know, this sounds really great, this balance of power. It sounds to me like a balance of terror and really a horrible thing to do in the name of oil diplomacy.
I agree. It was pretty sordid.
All right. In fact, and you know, of course, they sort of justified the fact that we were selling anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles to the Iranians. We had to get the hostages back. Do you think that was the real reason behind it, or were there other reasons?
No, there wasn't. It's hard to know what was in President Reagan's head, but of course, that was the reason he gave. He claimed that he wanted the hostages back so badly that he was willing to sell weapons to the Iranians because he believed that the Iranians, in exchange, would give him back the hostages. The problem was that every time he thought he had made a deal with the Iranians to have hostages released, it would have happened that, in fact, one or two hostages would be released, but then the Iranians would turn right around and grab two more. So we were constantly behind the eight ball, and we were constantly in the position of having to sell weapons to the Iranians.
And, of course, then the whole idea, the whole position of the administration was we will never negotiate with terrorists. And while we were telling the American people that, we were negotiating with the terrorists. And, of course, you know, once you've started giving them arms for hostages, then all they have to do is take more hostages, and you have to give them most more arms. And the American people really had no idea what was going on. And everything was a lie to cover up and prevent the American people from knowing. Wasn't that the case?
Yes, it was. But fortunately, if your listeners have the time, they can obtain copies of the report of the Congress on the Iran-Contra hearings, and it takes some research, but it's all in there, and the whole sordid picture is in there.
All right, fine. In terms of that, somebody once said the two things you never want to see, one is sausage being made, and the other is laws being passed, and I suppose that that's sort of an example of how it works.
Right.
All right, fine. Well, of course, then, of course, we fast forward to the time of 1990, and of course there was a confrontation between Kuwait and Iraq. And why was Saddam Hussein so concerned about what was happening at that time and the oil prices and Kuwait stealing his oil?
Well, you have to understand that the Iraqis, in order to fight that war, had to go deeply into debt. They borrowed tremendous amounts of money to buy weapons, not only from the Kuwaitis and the Saudis, but from the Europeans. And when the war ended, Iraq was under compulsion to try to get back on its feet financially as quickly as it could. And in order to do that, it had to get the debts rescheduled. Just at the point that the Iraqis were attempting to get those debts rescheduled, the Kuwaitis announced that the money that they had given to Iraq, and which Iraq assumed were a grant, was in fact a loan, and it would have to be paid back. As soon as the European banks heard that, they became unwilling to reschedule the loan, and Saddam Hussein became furious.
And so it was really the financial consequences of this war that resulted after we toppled the Shah and Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. So it was a direct result of that tragic situation that, of course, we see Iraq involved in a war with Iran, and then Iraq, of course, facing bankruptcy. And so now the European banks then are demanding payments. So then what happened,
Well, once Saddam Hussein became involved in this confrontation with the Kuwaitis, the thing very quickly developed. The argument escalated. Saddam Hussein was not about to back down. He wanted, one, that the Kuwaitis admit that that money was given to him, and therefore he did not have to pay it back. And along with that, he wanted the Kuwaitis to stop overproducing on their oil quota, because the more oil that was produced, the lower the price. And, of course, Saddam was depending upon selling his oil to try to dig out of debt.
In other words, by flooding the world with oil, Kuwait, overproducing, drove the price down so he didn't have the money to pay off his debts. Is that
right?
It?
He was in a position where he couldn't even pay the interest on the debt. And as soon as he got into that position, he fell back on the only card that he had to play, and that was force. He pretty much delivered an ultimatum to the Kuwaitis that they either did right by his life, they did what he wanted them to do, or else he was going to do something drastic. Well, the United States didn't take him seriously, and Kuwait didn't take him seriously, and that was a big mistake because, of course, he invaded.
All right. Well, of course, we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment. But when we get back, we want to talk about the American ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, who was called in for a conference with Saddam Hussein before he attacked Kuwait. And, of course, it is Saddam Hussein's contention that April Glaspie told him that America was unconcerned about his relationship to Kuwait. In other words, he felt that he was given the go-ahead to make the attack. And let's develop that as soon as we get back here from this next break. But right now, I certainly want to mention to our listeners that we have a number of items through Radio Liberty, which we think that many of you would be very, very interested in. And certainly, one of them would be my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which goes into the various organizations that work behind the scenes in every society, but specifically in this our society, and of course the spiritual forces behind these various organizations that seem to have a goal, and that would be a new world order and a new world religion. Now, the Brotherhood of Darkness is in about its sixth or seventh printing, published by Hearthstone Press. It's been well received across the country, and if you'd be interested in getting the book, it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then let me suggest you even a better situation would be to get the book and the video, which tells you basically the same story, and of course an audio tape, and they're all available for $29.95. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the Brotherhood of Darkness special. And then, of course, we have a number of other interesting four tape sets that will give you a real understanding of what's going on in America today. We have a four tape set on the Oklahoma City bombing that was made in 1996, 1997, and then we have an Oklahoma City bombing 1999. We call it the Oklahoma City bombing update, an interview with Carol Howe's attorney. Now, who was Carol Howe? Why, she was a woman who had infiltrated Elohim City for the BATF, and she had learned that there was going to be a bombing of the Murrah building. She had told the government that. She had told the BATF that. Well, how could you have that come out that at the McVeigh trial that the government knew ahead of time and did nothing to stop the bombing? So Carol Howe was arrested and charged with felonious charges, no basis at all, in fact. And, of course, the interview with her attorney, Clark Bruce, is there. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now.
The Anglo-American establishment gives you the documentation for Professor Quigley's allegation that there was a secret society created in England that ultimately came to dominate England and ultimately came to dominate the United States of America. The Anglo-American establishment will give you the books that you can read, written by men who were actually involved in the original secret society. Professor Quigley opens his book saying that most people have heard of the Rhodes Scholarships, and a few people have actually heard that Cecil Rhodes wrote a confession of faith, which was attached to his first Five Wills, talking about the formation of a secret society. But what almost no one in America realizes today is that that secret society was actually formed and still exists to this very day. The Anglo-American Establishment by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is one of the most important books you'll ever read, and available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest today is Stephen Pelletier, and of course we're talking about his book, Iraq and the International Oil System. And before we went to the break, I asked the question about April Glaspie's interview with Saddam Hussein, and of course you cover that in your book. Would you like to go into that, and of course what Saddam said about it, and your interpretation of what actually happened?
Well, Saddam invited, or actually I guess I have to say demanded, that Glaspie attend him at an interview. This was at the time that the Kuwaitis were giving Saddam trouble when they refused to stop cheating on their quota, when they refused to say that the money had actually been given to him rather than loaned. And Saddam called Glaspie in and told her in no uncertain terms that she had to tell her people back in Washington, that is then President Bush, to put pressure on the Kuwaitis to make them cooperate with Saddam so that he could get his financial house in order. And he said that he was being driven to take desperate measures unless something was done. He did not know what he could do. He complained, for example, that he didn't have enough money to pay the pensions of his war widows. So he was in quite a desperate strait. Glaspie told him that Kuwait was an independent country and that the United States could not compel them to do anything. Now, this was the official line that the United States was pitching at that time, but it had nothing to do with reality. Of course, had the United States gone to the Kuwaitis and said, you will do this, they'd have done it. But Glaspie, since she had no instructions from Washington, took the position that she would just tell Saddam what in effect was the line. And I think she was probably trying to buy time. But Saddam was under the gun, he felt. He was putting it to Glaspie that something had to be done immediately. And when she came back at him and gave him this dismissive reply that the Kuwaitis were free to do whatever they wanted to.
Or the Iraqis, wasn't it? Or was it the Iraqis or the Kuwaitis were free to do whatever they wanted?
She told him that she could not influence the Kuwaitis. Now, at that, and along with that, she said that we never interfere the affairs of nations in the Gulf. Now, some commentators in the United States have interpreted this as a green light for Saddam to go ahead and invade Kuwait. I don't think it was that. I think it was rather a case where Saddam was asking for help, and Glaspie, by taking this position that the United States was not in a position to help, unfortunately left Saddam to try to work it out as best he could, and the only way he could think of to work it out was to invade.
Well, of course, why then, when George Bush mobilized a coalition against him, didn't Saddam simply pull the military out of Kuwait and back down? Because obviously he was unable to hold out against the coalition that we had amassed, and certainly, you know, he did not have the military technology to counter what we had. It seems like such an illogical thing for him not to have done, simply back away as the Iranians had backed away after their humiliating defeat in 1987.
Yes, but you have to realize that the Saddam, by that point, had become pretty paranoid. He believed that the United States and the Kuwaitis, and the Saudis too for that matter, were planning to put him into a box, to get him into a position where he could not dig out. And the way they were going to strangle him was by cutting off his credit. He was not going to be able to get his debts rescheduled. He could not get money to put the country back in shape. He could not demobilize his army because the troops had no jobs to go home to. And as a consequence, he really felt that he only had one card left to play, and that was to hang on to Kuwait and force the United States to negotiate with him so that he could dig himself out from under. At a certain point, he came to realize that the United States was going to destroy him, and then it was too late. He couldn't get out. So he fought.
Well, of course, you know, I mean, it sounds from what you're saying is that the massive debts that he had incurred because of the war and the pressure being put on him by bankers and, of course, by Kuwait as well, really was then responsible for this whole tragic situation.
Oh, yes, I definitely think it was.
All right, fine. So then, of course, we have the Gulf War, and everybody knows it was a humiliating defeat for Saddam Hussein. So why then, in your opinion, did President Bush pull back at the last minute when, we were 60 miles from Baghdad, we could have gone in, and everything was in disarray. Certainly the people in the north had risen up because our president had promised them that he was going to take out Saddam Hussein, rise up, overthrow Saddam. The people in the south, the Shia Muslims in the south, certainly had risen up because we had promised them we were going to take out Saddam Hussein. And then after promising them and having these people risk their lives and many of them lose their lives, why we left Saddam Hussein in power? How can you justify that?
Well, I can explain it.
Okay, how can you explain that?
The war was tremendously costly. We had to move 500,000 troops to the Gulf. We had to provision them. We had to arm them. And then we had to fight a war, and all that cost enormous amounts of money. And we didn't pay a cent. The Saudis paid, the Kuwaitis paid, the Germans paid, the Japanese paid. Everyone picked up the tab for us, but our coalition partners wanted no part of an American occupation of Iraq. That was the stipulation. We would not occupy Iraq. And since we wanted to have the war paid for, and since we did not... we had accomplished what we said we had set out to do, which was to liberate Kuwait. It was convenient to stop where we stopped, and that's what we did.
But that was to betray the people that in the north and in the south that we'd, more or less assured that we were going to take out Saddam Hussein. So they were simply cannon fodder for Saddam's retaliation.
Well, it certainly was the case with the Kurds in the north. I think the Shia situation is more complex, but... no one expected that the Iraqi army would remain loyal to Saddam Hussein when it had been so thoroughly defeated, and that it would be able to put down an effective rebellion in the north. That was another big miscalculation of the United States. We thought that after having so soundly defeated Iraq, that his elite troops, the so-called Republican Guards, would turn against them. Instead of that, they remained loyal. They went north. They defeated the Kurds, and effectively they gave Saddam Hussein and his regime a new lease on life.
All right, fine. So then, of course, Saddam is reinstalled in power, and of course he really rules, though, by fear and by torture, and he even killed his son-in-laws, a couple of them, and had them tortured to death. And after they defected, and then he told them to come back, and they had nothing to worry about. He loved them, and all is forgiven, and they made the mistake of believing him. And of course, but then there were several, at least according to Robert Baer, who's a CIA agent. I don't know. Do you know Robert Baer's
work? No, I don't know.
He had written a book called See No Evil. He talked about how in both 93 and 95, the Iraqi military wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And each time, of course, we did not back them. And they, were, of course, were arrested and done away with. And so certainly 1995, the Iraqi military realizes it's certainly not going to get any help from us in overthrowing Saddam Hussein. We keep talking about wanting to do away with Saddam, and then when there's opportunities, we always seem to drop the ball. And you mentioned in your book that so often the American intelligence just seems so totally incapable of understanding anything over there.
Well, first of all, let me say this. You have to remember that... You have to be aware that Iraq has the largest reserves of oil in the world. And at the time when the Iraqis were selling their oil, this is before the Iran-Iraq war, the regime was very liberal in rewarding Iraqis. The Iraqis had the highest standard of living of any nation in the Middle East. Saddam Hussein made education available to any Iraqi that wanted it. You could go to school free up through graduate school. He also was tremendously forthcoming in allowing women to get an education. The Iraqis had more educated women than any other Arab state. As a consequence, you had this strange anomaly. You had a very repressive society which granted very few opportunities to people politically. That is, they couldn't organize, they couldn't speak out against the regime. But if they kept their noses clean, they lived very well. There was plenty of money, there was welfare, they were well taken care of to the grave. And as a consequence, many Iraqis today look back on that as the golden years. And so, whereas I'm aware that many people like this Mr. Baer that you're talking about say that the regime is hated and that it would be easy to overthrow, I'm not so sure. The Iraqis believe that when times were good, Saddam Hussein took care of them, and therefore is a question in my mind as to how quick they would be to overthrow him.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, that is the big question as we prepare for an invasion of Iraq. Will the Iraqi people fight for Saddam Hussein if we have a door-to-door, street-to-street battle, or will they simply turn against him? That's the question I think nobody knows the answer to. I certainly don't.
I don't think it's going to come to that. I think that we have such tremendous power that we can finish him off in a couple of hours. I think that we'll just sweep through the country like a dose of salt. That's a tragedy, but I'm afraid that's what the way it's going to be.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly hope that you're right, because the quicker the war ends, the less devastation there'll be, not only for our forces, but for the Iraqi civilians, for the Iraqi military, many of whom are conscripted into the army. All right, fine. Well, of course, but you think that really the common denominator here is oil and the fact that Iraq has such vast fields of oil and that must be controlled?
I think that if the United States does go to war with Iraq, if President Bush does take us to war at the end of this year or the beginning of next year, then there'll be no alternative for us. We will have to occupy Iraq, we will have to seize the oil, and we will have to use that oil to pay for our war against Saddam Hussein. And that's imperialism.
Okay, but certainly oil plays a large part in making the decisions as to what we do over there. Would you would feel that's true?
Sure.
All right, fine. And, of course, you know, what a terrible thing it is, because, of course, I think there are many people in the Arab countries who really feel that this is simply an example of American imperialism. And, of course, I think at one time America was very well thought of. I think increasingly America is growing to be hated over there, and I think this is a terrible, terrible tragedy. Well, right now, of course, I want to tell our listeners and remind them that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And we're really dependent upon the people who listen to our programs. If they agree that they're going to hear fascinating interviews here that you're not going to hear elsewhere, we hope that many of you will decide right now that you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you do that simply by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you'll get our four best tapes of the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter. But more than that, of course, you'll be helping us do what we do as we reach out across America, gradually expanding our base of stations. And right now, of course, our Saturday program is heard on, one Saturday program is heard on 35 stations. The other program is heard on another 5 stations. So Saturday, while we're reaching out across America, and during the week, we're heard 5 hours a day on the Internet, 2 hours a day on shortwave, 3 hours a day on satellite, and 5 hours a day on various radio programs and on 4 or 5 networks. So if you want to be part of our effort, if you would like to partner with us as we try to bring people the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and understanding of the geopolitical forces that shape the world in which we live, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then remember our website. It's www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can go there and link to our programs 5 hours a day. You won't get anything accomplished, of course, but you'll hear a lot of interesting guests. And, of course, please tell others about our programs and about the various things we have posted on our website at www.radioliberty.com. And we'll be back in just a moment with our special guest.
Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this afternoon is Mr. Stephen Peltier, and we're talking about his book, Iraq and the International Oil System, Why America Went to War in the Gulf. And of course this was written before the September 11th attack. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you would like to call us from the Pacific Coast, here, the Central Coast of California, the number is 464-8295. But right now, let's go to Dave, who's calling us from Illinois. Whereabouts in Illinois do you live, Dave?
I live in Peoria, Dr. Stan.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. A couple comments, maybe a question. Yeah, this whole thing is such a convoluted mess. And I've heard all kinds of discussions on this, as well as other programs. And I've concluded that, like your guest talked about the businesses selling to both sides during the Iran-Iraq war, to me that's totally evil. And that's an example of complete total corporate greed and corruption. I think those CEOs should go to chew out of jail for that. My second comment is, it sounds like this is such a mess that maybe we do have to go in. But what I think is a crying shame is, I think the politicians have put us there if you have to go.
All right, fine. But of course, they're not going to go. They're going to send our boys.
I'm just saying that would be more fair. I mean,
do you have a question for our guest?
I guess the question for him is, what does he think we should do?
All right, fine. Thanks so very much, Dave. Do you want to stay on the line or not?
I'll listen.
Okay, fine. Well, here's Dave calling from Peoria, Illinois, and I think he represents the way an awful lot of Americans feel. They're not quite sure how we got here, but what should we be doing? Should we be going to war now with Saddam Hussein as a result of the attack on the World Trade Center, or does the attack on the World Trade Center have anything to do with the fact we're going to war with Iraq?
I don't think we should go to war with Iraq, and I don't think that anyone has come up with any convincing evidence that Iraq has got anything to do with the attack on the Twin Trade Center. I think that's a completely different affair. In fact, the fact that President Bush wants to use the Trade Center as an excuse for going to war gets us right back into the question of oil. We're going in for the oil. We're not going in to defeat terrorism.
All right, fine. Well, you certainly won't get any argument here at all. And I think that what disturbs me most is that so many good people I know and I like, are all in favor of this war, and they've just never thought this thing through. So I agree with you. We should not be going to war there. But your book really is fascinating. I learned so much about the oil and about the original oil cartel that was set up between the Royal Dutch and between the Rockefellers, and then and then how that was broken, maybe we could just briefly touch on this, because you point out that the cartel was broken. And then, of course, there was always this effort to have some sort of means of controlling oil production. Do you want to sort of develop that for a few minutes?
Well, the cartel was broken in 1973 with the OPEC revolution. And at that time, the oil-producing states, that would be Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, all, I think there were about 11 of them, effectively took over from the oil companies. That is, they then control the oil. They determine how much would be produced, and they took all the profits. For a long time, they didn't have to be concerned about regulating the production of oil because the world was desperate for oil and tried to get as much oil as it could. And, of course, all that money flowed into the pockets of the oil producers. But in time, there became a glut of oil, and the producers found that they were producing too much oil. And at that point, they tried to do what the cartel had done before them, and that is to regulate production. And they were unsuccessful. They never were able to do that successfully. And as a consequence, for years now, since 1973, we've witnessed various attempts to put that oil system back into place so that production could be controlled, and it never quite succeeded.
Well, of course, what about the implications now of the pipeline running through Afghanistan and Pakistan down to the Indian Ocean? Certainly, aren't we seeing a situation now opening up the oil fields of Central Asia, around the Caspian Basin, and then now that we have the pipeline to get Russian oil, isn't this going to put a tremendous downward pressure on oil? Isn't there going to be almost a glut of oil, especially if we now can open up the Iraqi oil fields?
You know, the problem, however, is all of this is very iffy. The wonderful thing about Persian Gulf oil is that it's assured. It's in the ground. The facilities exist to get it out of the ground. And the whole Persian Gulf area, for one reason or another, is very secure. You move up into the Caspian region and you have no security. I mean, look at what has just happened in the last couple of days with the Chechens seizing the theater in Moscow and the Russians having to kill so many of the hostages and the hostage takers to get control of that situation. Well, Chechnya is in the area of the Caspian, and it is only one of the trouble spots in the Caspian. So when you talk about opening up the oil pipeline and developing the oil of that region, you have to be aware that this is all in the future. And whether that pipeline ever gets built and whether that region ever gets developed depends on a lot of imponderables, whereas in the Gulf, there's no imponderable. The oil is there, and we have access to it.
All right, let's go to Ann, who's calling. And hi, Ann. Where are you calling from?
Pennsylvania.
All right, Ann from Pennsylvania. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, a question, but I wanted to comment on what you just said. Yes, it's readily available in Iraq, but they have to rebuild the oil wells, is what I was told. Not completely rebuild them, but they've gone into a lot of disrepair. But I wouldn't argue about the stability of the area. But we are diversifying our oil around the world, as you know, and going into Africa and looking for it elsewhere. But I want to ask you, what is this big conflict that we see between the Democrats not wanting this war for oil and the Republicans wanting it? And you said that we would be imperial to go over there and take it, but isn't, in a sense, Russia and France, who already have developed oil interests there, aren't they already metaphorically occupying Iraq? And isn't it just to keep America out? Like, it's very confusing. If you look at the total picture, it seems like they want America to stay out of there, but they want to keep it for themselves, those who have already developed interest.
All right, let's ask Mr. Pelletier. Yes. And Anne's point is, look, you've already got the French involved with Iraq. We know that the Russians have been violating all the agreements and helping Iraq and taking oil out, and they've been smuggling oil out through Turkey, and everybody knows that there are a lot of interest there. And, of course, Anne feels that, of course, the idea is that we are being branded as imperialists for wanting to go in, whereas these other countries have already gone in. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, it's a good question. Obviously, Anne has done some thinking on this. Look at it this way. For years, the oil, as we've been saying, was dominated by the cartel. And the cartel companies were, as mentioned, American companies and British companies with a small Dutch influence. Royal Dutch Shell is partially Dutch. Now, these are all Anglo-Saxon, Northern European, and American companies. And for years, it was those countries that dominated the production in the Gulf and pretty much controlled the production there. Whereas countries like Italy and Russia, well, not so much Russia, but Italy and France, definitely, were always attempting to get into the Gulf and to get a stake in that oil production. And the Anglo-Saxon countries kept them out. It was during the Iran-Iraq War when Iraq desperately needed weapons and France provided them, that the French first got a foothold inside the Gulf. The Russians also got a foothold inside the Gulf because they too helped the Iraqis in the war. And after the war ended, this is the Iran-Iraq War, Russia and France were in a position to benefit because the Iraqis were willing to pay back for favors granted during the war. So the Russians and the French believe that they have a right to be in Iraq because they stood by Iraq when Iraq was fighting this desperate fight against Iran. And the Russians and the French look on America's attempt now to, as they see it, occupy Iraq as an attempt to cheat them out of what rightfully should be theirs for having lent the Iraqis all that money and given them all those weapons during the Iran-Iraq War. So that's really what's at stake. It's a clash of civilizations, the civilizations of France and Russia against the United States and Britain.
All right, fine, Anne. Let me just suggest an excellent, this is an excellent book, Iraq and the International Oil System. And then you may want to read See No Evil by Robert Baer. And then give us a call when we've got more time. But thank you so much for raising the question. Bye-bye. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Pelletier. I really appreciate so much your being willing to be with us here on Radio Liberty. And do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
I would reiterate what I said a moment ago. We should not go to war with Iraq. We should avoid this at all costs. And I'm afraid if President Bush does go to war, there's going to be a lot of grief for all of us.
All right. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, fine. Well, that was Stephen Pelletier, and I hope you enjoyed the book. It's published by Prager, which is an establishment publishing house, but it's got a lot of fascinating history in it. And, of course, my view on this thing is that things are never as they appear to be. And we just touched on the point that certainly this whole destabilizing of the area there in the Central Asia came about in 1979 when we toppled the Shah of Iraq. The Shah of Iran. We started the Afghan War by beginning to finance the Mujahideen in July of 1979. And 6 months later, the Russians invaded Afghanistan. And I believe, of course, that there's long-range planning to bring us to where we are today. I agree we shouldn't be going to war, but I fear we are. Go up to my website at radioliberty.com and pull down some of those articles we have up there. Read them carefully and then go to the documentation, and we'll be discussing more of this in the weeks and months that lie ahead. And please tell other people about our programs. Try to get them to listen. Try to get them to question what's going on. Let me suggest my September newsletter. It's up on the webs. Or if you'd like a free copy of this September newsletter, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's the September newsletter. If you haven't had one before, we'd be glad to send you one free of charge. Of course, we hope you'll subscribe, but... And then, of course, think very seriously about coming to our conference we're going to be having on the 23rd of November here in the Monterey Bay area, one of the most beautiful areas in the world. And we're going to be talking about preparation for the difficult times that lay ahead. And then please pray for Radio Liberty. Pray for our ministry, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back with you tomorrow at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you.